it's absolutely amazing what this kind of research is going to show us. So I think the direction that we're going in terms of helping people that have got quadriplegia or who have had a stroke or have, you know, lost the ability to speak for whatever reason, this is absolutely fantastic when it comes to that sort of thing.
Communication pathologist and clinical neuroscientist,
Dr. Caroline Leith,
specializing in the mind-brain connection.
We do not know enough about the brain. We do not know enough about the mind-brain interface, the mind-psychoneurobiology we're learning.
Is that even possible, you think? Something like a brain chip could connect the neurons that can cure depression or...
Yeah, great question. So...
Welcome back to Growth Minds, guys. Today we have Dr. Caroline Leith. She is the communication pathologist, audiologist, clinical and cognitive neuroscientist with a master's and PhD in communication pathology. She's also the best-selling author of Switch on Your Brain, Think, Learn, Succeed, Cleaning Up Your Mental Mess, and co-founder of the NeuroCycle app, which we can get into as well. Dr. Leith, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thank you so much. Great to be with you.
Great to be here as well. I was just kind of reading up on your story about being your, you know, hometown being in South Africa, which is such a fascinating story that, you know, hopefully we can dig into a little bit more as well. But this, I wanted to start this topic with another South African person that's inspiring the world, Elon Musk, actually, who is now making the news for a whole bunch of different reasons. But last week, he came out and said that Neuralink, which is this brain-computer interface, just completed their first human trials. They were doing, I think, monkeys before that and maybe pigs, but they were doing a bunch of different animal testing and they just completed their first human trial. And just as your background, based on, you know, your experience with neuroscience and particularly cognitive neuroscientists, what are your kind of initial thoughts when you hear that, I guess?
Great question. So my background is also in clinical research and did a lot of clinical work as well with people with traumatic brain injuries and autism and dementias and that sort of thing. And also involved when I first studied back in the 80s, that was when they were doing the first cochlear implants. And so there was a whole move in the direction of trying to, you know, get the mind-brain technology-brain interface. And I saw people that, you know, literally in the very early days back in the 80s that couldn't communicate because they were quadriplegic, being able to use these interfaces to communicate. So I think the direction of that we're going in terms of helping people that have got quadriplegia or who have had a stroke or have, you know, lost the ability to speak for whatever reason, I think this is absolutely fantastic when it comes to that sort of thing. Where I have concerns is when people think that this is now the answer to fixing mental health problems or that this is kind of, you know, the whole singularity where, you know, people are combining man and machine, and you know that brings us the question of free will and everything. I think there's a very narrow view of really how the mind-brain interface works, the mind-brain-body, the whole psychoneurobiological network, and just understanding more about the brain. So I think it's fantastic when it comes to, as I said, when it comes to people that have had some kind of damage, traumatic damage. I think it's absolutely amazing what this kind of research is going to show us. The danger comes in thinking that this is going to make a superhuman, that you can use some external implant to make you suddenly not have depression anymore. You know, these kinds of things are very, it's dangerous because they're non-specific. We do not know enough about the brain. We do not know enough about the mind-brain interface, the mind psychoneurobiology we're learning. We've known for thousands of years that the mind changes, the mind and the brain are separate, and the mind influences the brain and the body, and that the mind and brain mind is embrained and embodied. But a lot of this work in the digital interface with the brain is doesn't consider mind as being separate. It considers mind as a product of brain. And that concerns me. If you look at mind as a product of brain and think, well, if I can change brain and I can influence brain with technology, I can therefore influence mind. No doubt that there's a feedback loop, but they're separate. Mind is not the brain, and brain doesn't produce mind. When you're dead, your brain does nothing. It's the aliveness of the mind that is actually changing the brain. So there's just, I have concerns around that area. And also mental health as well. It's been medicalized. It's become a situation of, we have to look at a human's unique story. We have to look at the environment. We have to look at what a person's going through. We have to contextualize. We have to look at the holistic uniqueness of a person and their story and the environment that they live in. And socio-political, economic, things that are happening, what the expectations are. We have to look at all of that. Much more than we have to look at a gimmick to stick in the brain to fix mental health. We have to fix society. And I just want to keep a balance that we don't get so caught up with technology because it's so fascinating and so wow that we forget about the basics of, let's deal with poverty. Let's deal with, you know, the impact of politics. Let's deal with the impact of mothers having to work and not, you know, to getting enough childcare. Let's look at the adverse circumstances of, you know, poverty leading to addictions and abuse. And, you know, all these kinds of things. War, etc. We've got to address those things as opposed to thinking, well, a gimmick can fix it. Long answer, but yeah, there's good and bad.
Yeah, it kind of reminds me of how certain medicine that had one intention leads to another. I mean, I think from Elon Musk's perspective, his end goal has always been this idea of creating superhumans. But I remember, like, yes. I think like Viagra yes. was initially for heart pressure, mm-hmm. or sort of for so like heart medicine, pressure. But then it also, yeah, it's also obviously good for other things now as well. And it seems like that threshold of now, you know, catering to people that are paralegic is kind of the first step, but it is kind of scary to think about what are the other potentials and whose hands is it going to be going on. Yeah. Like what are the dangers? Like, is that even possible, you think, that one day something like a brain chip could connect the neurons that can cure depression? Or from your research and experience, do you think that has more danger than the benefits?
Totally. It has so much danger because the way that this, first of all, the superhuman, let's just address the superhuman concept, because there's the top sort of five people in the world, and Elon being one of those, that are going for the superhuman longevity, which is very trending at the moment, and very much, it's all based on something that you put into yourself and or something that you add. It's an external thing. But this, which is, and it's completely neglecting the internal work that we as humans, that's where our superpower resides. All those external things are just supportive, but they're also very non-specific. We don't know, as I mentioned in the beginning, enough about the brain to know that if I put a chip in this part of the brain, there seems to be a change in a person's managing of their emotions. But is that good? And what other impact does it have? We don't know that because it's so complex. It's not, when you look at the human as something mechanistic and you think, okay, one part's missing and I can, you know, add a part in, or if I remove this, it doesn't work like that. Everything works in a very integrated fashion. Our biochemistry, our psychoneurobiology is very, very, very linked. The downstream effect of one change is massive. We know that just, and we also cannot disregard mind in this equation. So in terms of fixing depression, it's how you define depression. Depression is not a bad thing. Depression is not an illness. It's not a mental disease. It's not a symptom that there's something wrong with you as an individual. It is a response to what you're experiencing as an individual. So therefore, it's a response versus a symptom. And it's a response that's very important because it gives us information. And, you know, Eastern philosophy said this for years. And for thousands of years, this has been, you know, the focus of so much spiritual and scientific writing. And in the last 150 years, we've had a lot of research. I do a lot of research with my team in the area of how our mind is actually the driving force. And that's where we must put our attention. So if we can balance, then it's better. But to say that you can plant a chip and it improves depression, it's first of all, what are you actually saying? What are you defining? What are the questions that you're asking? This whole thing of trying to be a superhuman, we're already superhuman. We need to access our superpowers and then use those as supportive measures, not in replacement of the whole concept of singularity, trying to, you know, get man to become a mesh with the computer or blend with the computer, and that will then release all of our humanity or our brilliance. Our brilliance is there. It's in our mind. And when and it's our mind that needs to be developed, and then use those with caution. And then just on another sense, on a neuroscientific level, most of the work in AI, and I mean, I'm totally pro-technology and AI. I'm not, I think it's fantastic if it's used correctly. But the philosophy behind all of these Neuralink, AI, all this philosophy, these digital technologies and this direction is based on the power of a neuron, one neuron. And one neuron fires at a certain speed, and yet we have somewhere between, we have about 100 billion neurons. And we don't yet understand what it means when two neurons fire together. We don't fully understand that power. What about 100 billion? We don't, you know, as soon as you've got three, you have a whole different story firing together. So that the nuance and the amount of amount of configurations are so unique to each human. The Blue Brain Project that was run by another South African, Henry Markram, he, I think it was almost 15 to 20 years ago, did a TED talk about 15 years ago about how within 12 years he would have built a brain that simulates the human mind. And 12 years into that project, he said they've spent, it was actually 20 years into the project, sorry, something like that. He said that the only, what they've done is they've taken all this time to identify one pathway in a rat's brain when they're in a maze, and that the number of combinations in a rat's brain in terms of the thinking processes is infinite. What, and so therefore in a human, you know, so wow. It's infinite. So, and then if you take it even further, you're talking about the firing power electromagnetically of a neuron. That's what they're basing AI and these things on. What about inside the neuron? There's the whole quantum world inside the neuron. Professor Hammerhoff and Roger Penrose, they were in the news just recently. I've been following them for years and going to be interviewing them on my podcast. But basically, Sir Roger Penrose and Henry Mark Stuart Hammerhoff have probably one of the most solid theories when it comes to consciousness and the non-conscious mind and so on. And they do a lot of work around the quantum vibrations within microtubules, which are inside, going inside the neuron. What's inside the neuron? What's inside cells? And you get what we call tubulin, which is protein, like little railway tracks. And there's quantum vibrations inside that. And that power is something beyond belief. And that's in one neuron, that power is mind-blowing. So now you've got the external electromagnetic, you've got the internal quantum, and then you've got the multiplication of 100 billion neurons. We're not even remotely close to even understanding any of that. So to say that we can plant technology in the brain, and the brain is going to now become superhuman, I've no doubt it will impact, because even if you take a ibuprofen, it changes the brain. Everything right. changes the brain. So it'll definitely impact us. But the claims that they make are unrealistic. That's my opinion, and the opinion of Sir Roger Penrose, Professor Stuart Hammerhoff, you know, people that work in that sort of line. They challenge AI all the time. It's actually quite interesting if you look at the comments and the Twitter string discussions, but Professor Hammerhoff challenges a lot of the AI sort of philosophy and conversations and things.
Yeah, there's always this double-edged sword with any new technology, any new medicine. You know, we had antibiotics that obviously helped us live all of this time fighting off infections, but it also kills all of our microbiomes, and we're, you know, just kind of learning about what microbiomes mean and how it's actually our second brain. And now we're talking about our actual brains, and you're talking about all of these neurons inside of the neurons, the billions of neurons that happen, and how we can all interconnect with each other. You just don't know what the consequences are. So it is kind of scary. Yeah. And I totally understand where you're coming from. And I think this kind of leads towards this idea of where the connection between thought and the brain and our body really comes into. And you talk a lot about this in your book, the difference between how traditional materialists used to think about the brain and the thoughts that come from the chemicals in our brains. And I guess, would you say like free will would be the other side there of what you're really trying to advocate more?
Yes, that's a good way of putting it. So I'm sure you would have seen in the news recently, I'm trying to think of the professor's name, but there's always been this debate about free will. And the oldest debates weren't around whether we had free will or not. It was all about we do have free will. It's only in the sort of modern history that we've really got into debating this thing of free will, especially in the last 50 years, as we've learned more about the brain, the concept of free will being an illusion. It's quite a new idea, a 50, 60, 70-year-old idea. And it's interesting because there's so much, it's how you look at the research. And so maybe we should start with, like, you know, what's the difference between the mind and the brain? I don't know where you'd like to start because this is a...
it's a complex topic. It's fascinating. And I know some people are more aware of it than others. So maybe we can start at the foundations of, like, the very, very basics for people that aren't aware of what the idea of, you know, the whole mind-body dualism and all that stuff is. So maybe we can just start by defining those basic elements and then we can kind of work ourselves up there.
Sure. So the mind has, as I keep saying, for thousands of years, we've always made the distinction between the physical and the sort of spiritual. And that was in early ancient writings and in early scientific research, even up until the, you know, I was studying in the 80s, that even in the 60s, 70s, and 80s, it was still very much that the mind and the brain are separate, that the brain is the physical, the body is the physical. And when you're alive, there's this mind force that is driving a response in the brain and the body. And that's the field that I come from. I believe there's more solid research like that. And I believe if you look at even the current research that says that the brain produces the mind versus the mind is actually using the brain and the brain is responding to the mind, if you look at the actual studies, they will do things like they'll tell people to think about something or read something, and they'll be connected to an fMRI machine. And so the brain is it's the response of the brain in certain structures, blood flow and magnetic resonance and that kind of thing. So in other words, the brain is responding, or QEEG, like we use in our research, picks up the energy response of the brain. And so what they're doing is they're getting a human who's alive to do something, and they're measuring a response. And they're saying that, oh, this part of the brain lit up, therefore this part of the brain produced what that person was thinking about.
But it lit up before, you're saying.
Sorry?
You're saying it lit up before that person made that action.
No, it lights up. Yeah, so there's the 10-second Benjamin Libet work, and I've done some work on this too. So there's this thing that the brain, areas of the brain will light up about 10 seconds before the person maybe picks up the teacup or responds to the whatever the experiment is. There's various different types of research. The one type is where they get a person to read or to just talk or to just think, and they see what's happening. And a certain part of the brain, as they instruct the person starts doing that, the brain starts responding. So the brain, the person is doing, their mind is in action. They're thinking about something or reading something or talking about something. That happens, and then the brain is responding. If the person was dead, they couldn't do that and the brain wouldn't respond. So we've got to be careful of the assumptions we make. We can't say that the brain made that person, because where's the life force? The life force is in you being alive. When you're dead, the brain just disintegrates. So therefore, it's because the person's using their mind that the brain is lighting up. But the way that a lot of the research is reported is that, okay, when this part of your brain lights up, it will produce that kind of emotion. And that research has been totally ripped apart by top neuroscientists in the world. It still is the dominant, what most people, when they're reading science articles that are more for the public, will hear that kind of language. They'll hear that the brain makes us do these things, or the brain lights up, or the frontal lobe produces your executive function. So you'll hear that kind of wording, that the brain produces. The brain doesn't produce, the brain only can respond. And there's a massive difference between if it's producing or responding. So if you look and really dive into the research, you'll see that they're actually looking at responses of the brain and the body to the mind. So for example, right now, as we are talking and people are listening to us and we're listening to each other, if we had brain technology like QEGs and fMRIs, and if we had an EKG monitor on, and if we had various different types of technology attached to us now, we would see a lot of responses happening as you and I are communicating. We could wear those Apple watches and we could look at our heart rate variability. You can even put your finger on the camera and you can see your heart rate variability that way. And so we're going to be responding. Our metabolism's changing as we're talking. So in other words, our ability to connect and communicate, we're thinking deeply, we're making choices about how I'm responding to you, your questions that you are asking me, the listeners, viewers, etc. All of that is mind. All of this ability of us to respond to life, to be a human, to love, laugh, do yoga on the beach like I was doing, as I was telling you just before we started, that I did sunrise yoga on the beach this morning. That ability is our mind. And our mind is helping us to experience life mentally, the yoga on the beach, the sunrise, this conversation. But our mind is also driving the fact that right now your heart is beating and your lungs are working to help you breathe and your genes are expressing in short, medium, and long-term ways, and you're making 800 to a million new cells every second, and I can go on and on and on. If you did, none of that would be happening. Also, your brain would have massive bursts of energy, and that we would pick up on a QEG. We would have a lot of blood flow going to certain parts of your brain, especially the front part now as we're talking, because we'd have a lot of conscious, deliberate, intentional interaction. That's all because you're alive. So remove your aliveness out of the picture. We would be dead. None of this would be happening. So at the most, it's a long explanation to help people understand that your mind is your aliveness. It's your sentience. It's your ability to experience life and to drive your physiology, two levels, experiencing life mentally and then driving your neurophysiology. And then your brain and body are responding. So your mind needs the brain and the body. Otherwise, how do you show up as a human? And the mind stores all the life, our life experiences inside the networks of the brain, inside the cells of the body, in these tubular things I spoke about earlier on as vibrations, and as well as in the brain, but in the brain, it's more tree-like structures. And also in the gravitational fields, we each have our own biofield around us. So it's stored there as well. So this conversation is being stored throughout your mind, which is waves throughout you. In your brain is a little tree that's growing. And in your cells, every cell, and you have 37 to 100 trillion cells in your brain and body, each cell is storing a version of this information. So there's a lot going on. So my mind is going to impact my neurophysiology, and that combination, mind, brain, body, is how we then show up. Does that make sense?
Yeah. I think so. I mean, I did some research before this, but I just want to break it down for people. So so the idea of like materialists is that kind of the way, I guess, most traditional scientists think about it is that the brain creates...
Modern scientists, I'd say.
Modern scientists as well. No worries. Yeah. So it's the idea is that for the materialists, the brain creates what you're doing and thinking. So the brain controls the mind versus... maybe free will or whatever nomenclature we want to put it there, is that the mind controls the body and the brain. And I think you, in one of your books, you have this this Nobel Prize winning neuropsychiatrist, Eric Kandel, who talks about this idea that our thoughts and the thoughts that we have can actually turn genes on and off. And that's something that he proved in one of his research papers.
Yeah, he started that thinking and he talks about how the brain and the body are wired for love. But he did a lot of work with the aplasia worm, and he showed that when we are alive and thinking, and I mean, they use the response of this little worm because it's easy to study the neural network of how as they are responding, there's this whole flow of neurochemicals and this whole flow of biochemistry and electromagnetic and quantum. He didn't talk about quantum energy. It was more electromagnetic energy, and that actually went directly to the nucleus, and the nucleus is where the chromosomes and the DNA are, and the genes are on the DNA. And there's an epigenetic factor. There's a switch on the genes, and it actually activated, switched them on and switched them off. And so, but if you're dead, that doesn't happen. So if the aplasia worm was dead, that response didn't happen. So he started a train of thought in that early years, because it's quite a few years back now, of the fact that our mind can change our brain. And then there's been a tremendous amount of research in the world of epigenetics, which is this field of external to the genes, there's an activating force, which is the environment, which creates an energy wave, which then activates the genes to switch on and off. And that energy force is influenced by our mind. Our mind creates that energy force, if that makes sense.
Yep. It does, yeah. And for, I think I can see why people have a hard time wrapping around it. Because you talk about the fact that if we are alive, then our brain is going to be working. But you could also argue the other side, which is our brain is who we are, and a brain's is really us. And if our brain shuts down, the reverse is true, in that we're not alive if the brain's is not alive. So like when I was thinking about this, because I actually advocate for like this idea of free will, and it's so much more empowering, the fact that we can have control over our minds, and that determines what our brain chemicals are. I mean, it just has all of the values that I believe in, like Carol Dweck's about growth mindset. But from a perspective of like the origins of where that mind originates from, like logically, it's easy for people to think that based on our brain chemistry, because that's a tangible thing, that what's what controls our thoughts and our minds. But if you reverse that and say that our thoughts and our mind controls what happens to the brain, where is the origins of where those thoughts and mind comes from?
That I can answer that, because the work that I do with my team, we do psychoneurobiological research. So I'm actually a psychoneurobiologist, mind, brain, body, and they all need each other. So that even though they're separate, they're interacting. So we talk about the embrained mind and the embodied mind. And so the fact that we see a shift and a change in our neurophysiology as we think is evidence of change. So we can see things, for example, like in short 9-week periods, we can see a change in telomeres. They get longer and healthier, and a telomere is the ends of a chromosome, and telomeres are very important for cellular health and biological health. And so there's direct evidence. We can look at various biomarkers in the body and in the brain to be able to see the influence and the impact of mind on the brain. And so essentially it starts in from the majority, if you actually analyze science over time, and you look at the history of science, and if you go back years and you look at comparing that science and modern science, you're going to see the majority of the research is explaining that it begins in your thoughts, with your mind. Your mind creates the thoughts. So with our mind, we experience this conversation, and we're turning the words into a thought, which is encapsulating. It's the experience. It's all the little things we're saying are the data of the experience, or the memories of the experience. So we're building a thought being an experience. So all day long, we are building our experiences with our mind into thoughts. And it's happening very fast, because then the mind has to put those somewhere and convert them. And that's where they go into the brain. And then the brain physically, it stores, it grows in response. The brain, that's neuroplasticity. I did some of the first work on neuroplasticity back in the late 80s. So the neuroplasticity is the ability, is the mind's thought. The mind experiences first. The mind is a gravitational field. It's an electromagnetic force. It's a quantum energy force, quantum field, and it puts into the brain, and the brain then responds. The body then also responds. So it's a mind-brain-body connection. So it starts in the thought. The thought is real. It's not something not some vaporous thing. It's an actual field. And this is where Sir Roger Penrose and Stuart Hammerhoff, they have the OCHR theory, which is basically how this energy from our experience, which is real energy, it's a gravitational field, as it enters into the brain, it collapses inside as a vibration inside a microtubule, a little protein, and it's a complex process, but it becomes something. The experience of the thought is an energetic experience. It's unique to that content, so it's got a unique signature, and it becomes, as it hits the brain, it becomes part of the brain. So it changes the brain. So if you think of something, if you have continual negative input, like let's say someone goes through continued abuse at any stage of their life, that if it's happening daily for a period of time, that that is changing the brain for sure. Everything changes the brain. Even this conversation's changed our brain. Your brain's never not changing. The question is, what's the direction of change? because the direction of, because the mind changes the brain and the body, and then that changes how we function. So if the direction of change is in a negative sense, where someone's being abused or politics, environment, adverse circumstances, just plain pure overwork, it may not be a huge trauma, just bad habits we develop, that is changing the brain. Now, let's take an example of someone who gets addicted, because that's always a good example. Addiction is not a disease, but addiction creates a change in the brain that can have disease-like manifestations. So let's say that a person generally, if you look at the concept of addiction, why a person's addicted is that they've chosen to take a substance or over-exercise or do something repeatedly as a way of avoiding, it's coping mechanism to avoid the pain of what they can't deal with. So they can't sit with what they've gone through, or there may be a series of things. And to numb that, something's done, a substance or an activity or something like that. Now, every time you do that, you're wiring it in the brain. Whatever you think about the most is wiring into your brain stronger and stronger, and your body. So the network is becoming stronger and stronger. Our networks, our psychoneurobiological networks, that's what drive how we function. So when it's good or bad, it becomes entangled into the brain and body, and a feedback loop is set up. So the brain and body do influence the mind for sure, but the mind is still stronger. And you have different levels of mind, and you have the messy mind, which is messy. It's just doing life. And then we have our wisdom, our wise mind. And that's in our non-conscious spiritual part of us. I've done a lot of work in that area. And that's the part that we need to get access to. And that takes training and skill, because most of us can get lost in the messiness of the mind, the messiness of the entanglement inside the brain, and we get into these feedback loops. And so that's what we want to break. And that's what the work that I've been doing all these years is, how can we recognize when we've got into one of these entangled feedback loops, and how can we stop that and break that entangled feedback loop and rewire that network. And you can't ever change what's happened to you, because it's part of you forever. But you can change the messiness of that network. So where it's a big mess and it looks different in the brain, mind, and body, you can clean it up. And you can then still remember what happened, but you clean it up in a way that then the network that then drives you is a cleaned up network, and therefore drives not an addictive behavior, but then you would use the alcohol correctly. You'd have a drink with friends as opposed to drinking to numb your emotions constantly, you know, that kind of thing. And that's what we can learn to do. And that's linked to habit formation. And it doesn't happen overnight. It does take time, but it's driven by the mind. It's a decision. It's a choice. It's driven by the mind. No matter how far down the addiction pathway or trauma pathway we are, with the right kind of support and awareness of, you can do it. Because people in our current day and age are told it's a disease, you have no control. That's not true. That is not true at all. It's been disproved by so many neuroscientists and people in the field. We do have control. It feels like we don't. And it's very understandable when you're in that really bad place. You feel like you have absolutely no control. And that's why community is so important. That's why the support of community, to actually give you the strength to face yourself and to then deal with stuff. So I saw in my practice, I've seen over the years, we've reached millions of people, and then just know from colleagues in the field and just reading books and reading people's lives and stories and testimonies, it's when you get the support of community. So someone who's very often will find people that are stuck in addictive patterns. By getting into a community of other people who've experienced the same sort of thing and falling in love, or having a network of people that are just a great friend or a circle of friends, that gives the person the courage to say, okay, I think I'm going to try and, you know, start building up my strength. And I'm only as broken as what I choose to be. I'm broken. And that brokenness won't go away, but I can fix that brokenness, the Kintsugi principle, you know, where you can turn that into something beautiful. But that takes support of community for you to see that you have that courage and strength, and then for you then to go through the really hard work. And that is another side of things, that there's a very determined healing journey that people go through. And in our current languaging of psychology, psychiatry, Instagram therapists, etc., the cycle's not fully explained. And this is where I emphasize so much in my work, because if you don't understand the healing journey, you're going to get caught and get stuck. And that's what happens so often. It happened when I was still practicing. People would come to me, we get the emails. In other words, for example, around about 21 to 30 days, between 21 and day 28, is a danger zone. So you can be really cruising along, doing this work, got your community, doing whatever. Maybe you're doing my neurocycle, maybe in therapy, you're doing whatever you're doing. Maybe you're just reading a great book and you're just getting into something that is, and you can hit this danger zone where you think, okay, I've got this. It's fine. I think I'm getting this right. And then you stop working on it. You're going to crash within a few days because there is a natural healing cycle that is rhythmic, up and down, and there's certain peaks and dips. And if you are prepared for the peaks and dips and you know what they feel like, you know what to do. But if you're not prepared for the peaks and dips, it throws you. You know, and that's what I try and do with my work, is to help people understand that peak and dip flow. And there's so much free will, and there's so much humanity and compassion and hugeness of people's stories that are involved in that process.
Yeah, that example you just gave me around addiction, I think can clarify, at least it did for me, which is the idea that something, an event happens to you, so most of the things you can't control, and it's up to you to decide how you react to that decision. And it reminds me of the quote from Rene Descartes, who also talks about mind-body dualism. I think he was kind of the first people to really talk about that.
Rene was, Descartes.
And he talks about, I think, therefore I am. And yes. I love reading biographies of entrepreneurs or people that have done inspiring things, like leaders. And it's fascinating to hear almost everyone, all of these guys that have been to the top and are at the top, have gone through hardship, trauma, hardship, difficulties, where they have to fight for their lives. And it's interesting that those people that went through those same events, a few of them decide that this is an opportunity to be better and to work harder and to fight for their lives, to become the president of the country or to become leaders of their nation. And while others falter to that, it's the exact same event, but the reaction to how what happened led to a completely different outcome. And while most people might think about, if you were a materialist, thinking about that as event X happened, and therefore this affected my brain, which is Y, and then the result is Z, nobody would actually rise to, you know, and overcome the adversity if that's the way they thought.
Yeah,
and I think it's a fascinating example.
Yeah, absolutely. It's. I mean, know that. Why are we so fascinated with people overcoming? Why is every movie and book and fantasy book so captivating? Because of the hero's journey and the overcoming of the odds. And, you know, we root for that. We know that instinctively as in our humanity. So if you remove that, you remove our human, you literally remove our humanity. And then you take hope away. And then what's the point? You know, if my life has been predicted and I have no influence over my life, you know, what is the point? And it removes a lot of, you know, hopelessness. I mean, we can go into so much science and technology, scientific stuff here, but it's really gut instinct. Sometimes I tell people, you don't have to be a scientist to understand this. In fact, sometimes scientists confuse everything and make just what is really simple and obvious very complex. And we need science. Please, I'm a scientist, so I agree with it. But for example, in my field, the hard question of science is, what is consciousness? For me, that's the most obvious question of science. I don't agree that it's a hard question. I just have to look at you and your questions you're asking me and the way you're thinking to know that I'm looking at brilliant consciousness that's driven by brilliant non-consciousness. So, you know, it's like we look for things. We want to make everything physical and have some tangible way of explaining. And that's why we're so fascinated with Elon Musk's technology and why we're so fascinated with AI. And it's great. We've got to have that fascination. It's great to see the impact of our life when I do a QEG and, you know, someone and you see their brain physiology, we're building that into our app so people will be able to learn, see that. It's wonderful to have that physical feedback. But at the end of the day, it's the non-conscious, which is still a level of physicality, but it's a spiritual level. It's a deeper level. It's a connected level. That is where the work is. And our current messaging of, as soon as you feel any pain, let's numb it. As soon as you feel any discomfort, there's something wrong with you. It's a symptom of something wrong with you. That message is terrible. And that message has been a message for about 40 years, and it has produced a basically a pandemic of problems in people's mental health because it's taken that hope away. We've got to process. We've got to be sad and happy and anxious. None of it's bad. All of it's part of a message of what we're going through in our life. And if we don't manage it, it can become disruptive, obviously. But managed, it's a message. It's a learning. It's a growth, etc. It's an opportunity to repair.
Do you think that's because humans are wired to be pessimistic from an evolutionary perspective?
Not at all. I agree with Kandel and a lot of Candace Pert and a lot of Stuart Hamhoff, Penrose, a lot of these leading scientists and philosophers that talk about the fact that we're wired for love. I'm totally, if you look at the human body, for a moment, let's move the mind out of the picture and you just look at the brain and the human biology, our neurobiology. It's phenomenal. It's all geared to work and to work in our favor. And this is why Eric Kandel talked about the fact that we're wired for love. We're quite literally wired for love. And so when something like disease hits our body and there's an invasion of a virus in our body fights that because it's trying to, it's wired for love. It's trying, it's geared for survival. So this whole thing of pessimism gear and people being drawn to the negative and that kind of thing, let me flip that on its head and give you another angle. Because at its most obvious, if you look at it in a very obvious way, it sounds like people are drawn to, you know, always watching the negative side or wanting bad news or getting fascinated with bad news or being drawn to, oh, did you hear this negative thing, and not paying enough attention to the good stuff. The reason that people do that, I believe from an evolutionary, from a spiritual, from a scientific perspective, and looking at the whole psychoneurobiological network, is because we're drawn to bring balance. So when there is something like a terrible thing happening in a country, like in the Ukraine, like in Sudan, like in what's happening in Israel and Gaza, what's happening to a child who's being abused, we are drawn to that not because we are drawn to pessimism and evil. We are drawn to that because it's unbalanced. Our natural instinct is that's wrong. How can we fix it? We need to pay it attention to be able to solve the problem. Now, if we don't manage our mind, once again, balance. If we get drawn to it and we don't work towards solutions and we just get caught up in the actual sensation that it generates, we're going to tip, and then we don't get constructive and things get worse. But if we constructively say, okay, that I need to be aware, what can we do? What are the action steps? How do I move forward? Why is this happening? What can we do? Then we keep the balance and we keep our empathy driving us in the right direction.
Yeah, I heard the argument from like an evolution biology perspective that, you know, it's only been like a couple hundred years where we lived in a world that's fully, you know, fairly safe. And we obviously had to survive, and any sort of bad news was a way to you know, kind of live another day and to look out for danger. But I think the idea that we're wired for love and optimism is certainly the outcome that we want. If people are like, I guess how much of this is also external stimuli, like, you know, us watching the news and seeing all of these, you know, bad things that are coming out, or social media and comparing ourselves to other people. How much of that is kind of, in your perspective, unwiring kind of the natural process of the idea that we are wired for love?
So that's one of my favorite questions. So just quickly on the evolutionary biology side, I always challenge that too. I don't think that danger's changed. I don't think that it's got more dangerous. It's just different. Every single generation has faced their kind of danger, facing a lion in the wild, which is always the example that's used, right, versus what we are facing now. It's just different. It's not that humans have always faced problems and danger. So this thing of, oh, we've got it worse now, it's just different. And so it feels different. It's like when the older generation talks to the kids, in my day, this and this, and it's so different. You know, we've got to be careful of that, because it's not that it was better or worse. It's different. And, you know, you can analyze both. Then in terms of the second part of your question, oh gosh, now I lost my train of thought. Just remind me again. Sorry.
External stimuli and like watching the news. Yep.
Yes. So in the beginning, when we started this conversation, I've said it quite a few times throughout, the context of a person's life is really important. What's around us is affecting us. So from my research, I've shown based on the work of Erin Najad, who's another very famous guy who does work in in the field of unconscious mind. Basically, we are absorbing 95% of our environment. So yes, context is important. Christopher Fuchs is a quantum theorist, and he talks about it's not about you, it's about you in the world. And so I'm a huge proponent of being aware that we are aware of maybe 1 to 5% of what we're focusing on. That's what our conscious mind can kind of deal with, about, you know, 1 to 5% of what we actually
need to focus on. That's crazy to think about, yeah.
It is crazy. So we're aware of focusing on this conversation. Maybe there's some sounds around you. What's coming up, whatever. That's only about 1 to 10%, but there's a bunch of other stuff that's going on in this world around you. You're not hearing every conversation. You're not reading every news broadcast at the moment because you're listening to this podcast, or you and I are doing this podcast. But there's a news feed on our phone. There's TV, there's whatever, there's all the things that you spoke about in our environment, knowing where you are in the United States, in what part, what's happening here, what's happening. All of that, we are constantly, 95% of that is going in on a non-conscious level. So we're absorbing it all. It's going into our mind-brain-body connection. Fortunately, we have within the depths of our non-conscious, we have this wired for love nature that is reflected in our biology, and it's all about survival. So although everything's coming in, most of it is disseminated into heat energy. But some of it will stick. And what sticks is what we choose to consciously concentrate on. So it's all coming in. But if I then go and read and get a completely down a rabbit trail of negativity in some TikTok feed about whatever, then I am taking what was the 95% of my environment, I'm taking that in, and most of it will go. But there's a section that your non-conscious wired for love spiritual nature will say, don't go down that road. But you ignore that because you consciously get absorbed in that TikTok string of videos for the next 3 hours and daily, and you get caught up in this thing. And so now you strengthen and build a very strong network, and it's that has now going to influence and drive you. So it becomes part of your psychoneurobiology, all that mind trees, whatever, all the stuff I spoke about earlier on. So absolutely, our environment does. So we need to train ourselves and our children to be much more aware of the impact of the world on us through looking at, you know, how are you showing up? We need to be much more self-regulated. Self-regulation has gone down a lot in our recent years because of we become so responsive. We want a quick fix. We want a pill for every ill. We want a feel good immediately. We want immediate satisfaction. And I'm totally for media, as I said. I mean, I love TV. I love social media. I think it's all fantastic. But if you don't manage it, it manages you. So I'm all for having everything that we've got in our advanced technological age, AI, everything. But how are you managing it? How are you perceiving it? How are you viewing it? How are you, tuned into the impact of when you sit on that TikTok feed for the next hour, what it does to you? And why do you question? Do you just get sucked into it? Because if you're getting sucked into it, it's going to wire in and affect you, and you're going to feel hovering anxiety and potentially a bit depressed, and then you're going to think, you know, and it carries on for days and days, and you're going to be told you have a mental health disorder when you don't. You haven't managed your environment. You're not self-regulating sufficiently. So I'm a huge proponent of self-regulation, which is why I teach people to be empowered to not rely on an external therapist or an external coach or an external, but to learn to rely on yourself. I'm not that I'm anti-therapy, and those are very necessary. But even those, you have to regulate. You don't want the therapist to regulate you. You go to them for support. You need to get what you need, and you should be driving that process. But that comes with self-empowerment first. It's really important we start with enabling ourselves and our children. I mean, that's why my most recent book is geared to help parents, to help children as young as 2 and 3 to start learning how to self-regulate. This skill is vital. It's vital to being able to recognize the impact of life and to then be able to process and face and deal and sit with the uncomfortable.
When you say self-regulate, do you mean having the discipline not to look at that TikTok feed or not to reach out for that cabinet for the junk food? Or is it more about the emotions of being able to regulate our internal thoughts? Like, can you talk about that and maybe talk about some of the ways that we can start to retrain our brains so that we can self-regulate?
So retrain our messy mind and our brain. So self-regulation is a skill that develops right from very, very young. And it's self-regulation is very much about recognizing, when you gave the example of like not reaching out for that junk food or not, you know, watching, getting stuck on TikTok or whatever it was, that requires motivation, and it requires a lot of, willpower. And there's a lot of interesting research around that. I remove that from the equation, because the minute I tell myself I've got to do something or not do something, we know as our human nature, it's called the white bear effect, we're going to want to do it. So we may stop it for a while, but it's not going to be a sustainable behavior. We're going to go back to that because our willpower will, you know, we'll give in, and which is natural, normal. And then we feel bad about ourselves and it creates a negative cycle. So it's best, self-regulation is one of recognizing and being able to read that in this moment when I have a desire to reach out and have more junk food, let me just take a moment to gather awareness of what am I showing up in my emotions. Emotions are not illnesses, they're signals, they're telling me something. If I feel an emotion, where do I feel this in my body? So maybe I'm feeling, if you actually stop and look, maybe it's frustration, or maybe it's a bit of self-esteem issue there. In your body, maybe your heart's palpitating, or maybe your gut grumbles, which maybe sends a sign, oh, maybe I need to eat something. So it's emotions first. That's as a signal. Your body, where do you feel that in your body? What are you doing? What are you saying? What are you doing? How are you saying and doing? Or how are you about to say and do something? You know, stop and ask yourself that. And then what's your perspective in the moment? Those are four categories of signals that work together. And when it comes to self-regulation, you are pretty much learning how to read those four signals and train yourself to pay attention to those. And what hits you first is your emotion. Or it could be, you know, generally it's like you'll feel this whoosh of emotion. You'll feel a physical response in your body. And if you just slow down for a few seconds and ask yourself four questions, what are my emotions in this moment? Maybe one, maybe two, maybe three. What am I feeling in my body? Where am I feeling this emotion in my body? What am I about to do? What am I doing? Maybe already you're withdrawing, or your shoulders are tensing, or you're pulling back, or you're walking away from something that you were walking towards, or whatever. What's my perspective in this moment? Oh, life sucks, or I'm terrified, or whatever. By doing that, you flip the neurophysiology and the psychoneurobiology on it from being controlled to controlling. And in doing that, you can then go through a process of, okay, this is where I'm at. You could do a little bit of breathing, because it could, just to calm you down. Oxygen is information, and we know that that then sends a calming, calms down on your chemicals and on your physiology and our stress axis and all that stuff. And then you can say, okay, well, why am I feeling this response? Why am I responding to this? Do I like this? Do I want this? You know, visualize it. What could I do instead of this? How can I reconceptualize this? You know, what action could I take in this moment to, and those very distinct steps, which are called the neurocycles, five steps that I just described, gather awareness of your signals, reflect on them, visualize or write, recheck, and active reach. That is how I've spent 38 years researching how does stuff get into your brain and how can you reverse engineer that. So now something triggered you, you had a response, and self-regulation is stopping and taking that pathway of the network of how that got in, catching it before it becomes something that drives you, and reverse engineering it to see what it is and what you can do about it. And that's a skill that you develop over time and get better and better and better and better and better at it.
What are those questions again? Because I think the hard part for a lot of people is just the idea of being self-aware, right? It's almost, people can kind of get stuck on that first step because
they react. They do.
Do you recommend asking questions then? Asking questions to yourself. And what are those questions again?
So basically there's general awareness and things like meditation and breathing and that sort of thing and mindfulness, which are very popular, as we know. That is preparing the brain and the body and the mind. And that will create an awareness of the thoughts, the intrusive thoughts and whatever's coming up and so on. If you stop there, you're going to throw yourself in a tizz. What a lot of people do is they shift from that and then they shift to a technique. And that technique could be breathing, which is also preparing the brain, but you can actually breathe to calm yourself down. As you know, or you could do a visualization, or you could do a CBT technique, cognitive behavior therapy. So there's a lot of techniques that you can do, which are band-aids. So in the moment, I can do that to calm me down so I can go into my meeting. Now, that's not bad. But if that's all you do, it is bad, because it's kind of like putting your hand on a hot stove and taking an opioid because it's sore, but never removing your hand from the hot stove, and eventually you're going to burn a hole through your hand. That's not going to help. I need to not just try and numb the pain. I need to say, why am I showing the signal of pain? What am I doing? Oh, I've got my hand on the stove and the stove is on. I've got to find the source. So that processing is a process. Most people will become aware and then technique it away. That doesn't create sustainable change. So what I'm saying is self-regulation is much more than that. Self-regulation starts with that awareness, that general awareness, but then you become focused. You go from general awareness, mindfulness, breathing, that kind of stuff, into focused awareness, which is what I call the gather awareness, gathering, you choosing. When you gather, you are selecting. And you select, what am I feeling? You can ask yourself and answer yourself in a sentence. Where is it in my body? What is my behavior? What am I saying and doing? What is my perspective in this moment? Then you say, why? You reflect. Why do I feel this? Answer yourself. Discuss with yourself. Write that down. Visualize it. If you're in a position where you can't write it down, you're in a meeting or you're driving the car or you're in a conversation, visualize it. If you'll see my NeuroCycle app where I talk about this whole thing and I take you through this as a therapy technique. I'm describing it now as an in-the-moment technique. So the NeuroCycle can be used in the moment, and it can be used as a therapy technique for your self-empowered therapy technique to help you deal with trauma, habits that you've developed, all that kind of stuff. And then the next thing is to say, okay, well, this has happened. What do I do? So step four, what do I do? Step five, okay, what's my action? How do I put the what do I do into an action step? And that's fully, as I said, I've got the app. It's actually called NeuroCycle. It's available on iTunes and Google Play. And I also explain it in my books, Switch on Your Brain. The best book is this. The most recent two books are these. So if people want to know more, I do explain this process. I'm out of the camera range. There you go. You mentioned nice. Those. Because I know I'm showing a lot out quickly, but I go into detail about that.
It seems like, when I think about the process, at least for me, you know, that self-awareness is, one, if you meditate, if you're kind of practicing that set, okay, it's good. But let's say you went through some traumatic event. Let's say something so negative, you know, your partner cheated on you, or you went through some childhood trauma, or you got fired from your job. And it's one of those things where, like, that's step number three. Man, that's tough for people to focus in on those thoughts that you have, because it's such a negative feeling that people kind of want to run away from that. Mm-hmm. They don't want to address it. And do you have any tips for when you work with clients where their instinct is to run away? It's this fight or flight instinct of, okay, I don't really want to address this negative thought because it makes me feel a certain way. It makes me feel stressed, and I'm already so stressed with some other things. What are your advice for people that need to go deeper into that awareness but are struggling to?
So it takes a full 9 weeks minimum to work through dealing with something like a trauma. The bigger the issue, the longer it's going to take. But this healing journey cycle is around 63 days, between 59 and 66. So it's around 60, which is around 9 weeks. And you go through the up and down that I mentioned earlier on through that process. So you wouldn't do the NeuroCycle once. But the whole thing, what I've shown with my research, is that you need a planned and guided daily process that that aligns with how you rewire the brain. And that's the five steps that I've described with the NeuroCycle. And you do that daily for around 5 to 15 minutes for 63 days. And there's a whole cyclic process. Now, in the app, I walk you through that whole cyclic process. So you do it with you hold my hand. So it's one theme. So it could be the trauma of the divorce or the trauma of whatever it may be. So the big stuff, you need to walk through the full 63 days. And sometimes, I mean, I've had some patients who've had years of so much childhood abuse that it's taken up to two, three years to work through, but regular cycles of 9 weeks. So if you think of 365 days and you divide it by 63, it's around about six of these cycles you would do in a year. Sometimes the trauma is so big, you'll need to do six cycles or 12 cycles, but each cycle, each 63-day cycle where you do the NeuroCycle within the cycle, every day you're doing the little mini neuro, you're doing little mini lots, every day you're doing a full mini NeuroCycle over 63 days, different things happening, and I guide you through that process. You are rewiring the network. you learn to sit with the uncomfortable. You learn to face the intrusive thought and see that it's not something bad. It's actually information, and it makes you feel bad, but you can rewire that and it's not going away. But so you learn all those things, but it can't be done quickly. Quickly, you'll just wipe yourself out. That's why it's a tiny little bit each day. And that's why I say 5 to 15 minutes, very disciplined. I mean, literally put on a timer and do 5 steps, do a minute on each step. You don't have to finish. You're not solving it in one day. It's little bits each day, which really changes the process.
Yeah. And it's particularly for people that may not have access to a therapist. And it's a way to self-regulate, as you say, to be able to go through that process of rewiring on your own time. Or maybe it's obviously something you can do with a therapist as well.
Absolutely. Because your therapist is not with you 24/7. You're with yourself 24/7. So this is something every human needs to learn. We all need to learn to be self-empowered, to self-regulate or manage our minds, which is how I talk about it. And then the therapist plays a support role. Sean, I'm so sorry. I know you edit, but I've got another interview and I didn't realize it's really after 10.
I was just finishing up. Okay. Yeah, no worries. I'm going to mark this so I can cut that part out. But okay,
we got perfect. So caught up in the discussion. I was chattering away. Oh my gosh, text from my producer saying you got another interview.
All right, let me just wrap this up. Well, Dr. Leaf, I want to close this off. I really want to thank you and appreciate you for the insights that you've provided. Where can people learn more about you before we close off here?
Absolutely. Well, thank you so much. I've loved our conversation. It's been you talking about all the things I love talking about. People can find me on social media, Dr. Caroline Leaf. I'm on all my social media handles. Our webpage is drleaf.com. And my podcast is called Cleaning Up the Mental Mess. And my books are available everywhere. We also have a site, drleaf.com, where they can go and get the books. And the NeuroCycle app is available on Google Play, iTunes, and there's a web version. And yeah, there we go.
Beautiful. We'll link all that below. Thank you guys for coming on, Dr. Leaf, and thank you guys for tuning in.
Thank you so much. Lovely to meet you.